In early 2002, three British citizens were transferred as enemy combatants to the detention center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Rul Ahmed, Shafiq Rasool, and Asif Iqbal had been arrested in Afghanistan in the fall of 2001. They've come to be known as the Tipton Three, and now the story of their two-plus-year incarceration has been told in The Road to Guantanamo. The film, which opens tomorrow at the Angelica and the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, won a Silver Bear for Best Director at the Berlin Film Festival. And joining me now are the director, Michael Winterbottom, and Rul Ahmed, and I'm very pleased to welcome them both to my show. Hi.
Hello.
Rul, you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you. Hi.
Michael, you're listed as co-director. How did that work?
It just meant that there was a bit less work to do. Matt Whitecross was the other director, and Matt started off by spending about a month living with Rul and Shaf and Asif and interviewing them every day, getting a lot of the background research to the story. And then from then on, we just shared the work.
Well, your last film was Tristram Shandy, A Cock and Bull Story, which couldn't have been more different than this. So how do you pick the films that you choose to work on?
Well, in the case of Guantanamo, I think I read a newspaper article about Rul, Shaf and Asif, and it seemed like an amazing story. So I approached their lawyer, Gareth Pierce, and we met up. I'm not quite sure when it was. I think it was about a month after they'd been released, or maybe even slightly less. And we just said, if you want to tell your story, we'll try and help you.
And then you decided that the best way to do it would be to recreate the scenes of their story?
Yeah, part of the film is them talking direct to camera, telling their story. And then in order just to make it kind of more vivid and simpler and easier to understand, we also recreated the journey they made. So we did a journey from England through Pakistan to Kabul, and then the whole process from there to Guantanamo.
Actors play them. Since the experience was so grueling, I imagine that it must have been grueling for the actors as well, even though they could get up and go home.
Well, originally I said to the actors we wanted to make it as realistic as possible so that we would just keep them in the in Guantanamo. When we got to Guantanamo, we'd just keep them there for the whole time. But in reality, you know, as soon as they were inside, they got very claustrophobic and wanted to keep coming out. And there's a lot of things like the shackling and so on, or the stress positions. But when the actors tried to do that, after about a minute or 2 minutes, they're like, it's too painful. We can't do this anymore.
Rul, were you enthusiastic about participating in this? Didn't it mean reliving a very traumatic time in your life?
I mean, initially we didn't really want to make the film because we wasn't sure if Michael was going to portray the real side. You know, is the film going to show? Is going to do justice to what we've been through? But having many meetings with him, he convinced us that he's going to try his best. And then at the end of it, lawyer also advised us that, you know, it's going to take nearly 2 years to make the film, or 18 months, and by then it'll die down in the press, so, you know, we can get back to normality. So that was one of the reasons we also made the film.
And I suspect from what you're saying that you're happy with the way it turned out.
Yeah, definitely. I'm very, very pleased. I'm very pleased the way Michael and Matt made the film, definitely.
So can you take us through the bear story? You went to Pakistan to be the best man at a friend's wedding.
Right.
When was that?
That was in October 2000. That's when I went to Pakistan for Asif's wedding.
Well, how did you and your friends...
2001,
sorry.
2001.
Not long after 9/11, and then you decided to go to Afghanistan. Why did you do that?
Well, there's two reasons we wanted to go to Afghanistan. One was because at the time, prior to going to Pakistan, there was a lot of media coverage about the Taliban government and how they were... So we were curious about that. So we wanted to go to Afghanistan as well. It was adventurous, so we wanted to go. At the same time, the mosque we were staying in, they had a humanitarian aid group leaving the same night. And it was just like a kind of, you can call it a coincidence, really. We wanted to go, and that group was leaving. So we thought, yeah, we'll go to see the Taliban government at the same time. We can see Afghanistan, and at the same time, we can go with a humanitarian aid group and also do some aid work. And it'll be a good adventure.
But considering what had happened on 9/11 in New York and Washington, was early October 2001 a good time to take off for Afghanistan? And to take off, I think this is the one thing that has really bothered people about the story. they feel that you as three British citizens should have not been going to help the Taliban.
Well, the humanitarian aid group who left from Pakistan wasn't going to help the Taliban. They were going to help the civilians, the people in Afghanistan. And number two, you know, people might say it was a bad timing. You know, why did we go when America was going to attack Afghanistan? But at the time, I was 18. I was young, you know what I mean? And my world was Tipton, and I didn't really pay attention to the world. So to me, it didn't really bother me if anyone was going to war. You know, it wasn't happening to me, and I wasn't really interested in news, so I wasn't really paying any attention if they were going to attack or not. So, and being, you know, naive and stupid at the time, you know, you don't think of the consequences that can happen.
Did you ever end up doing any charity work?
Yeah, I mean, we did just a bit, but it wasn't what I expected. So that's why we asked to leave, to go back to Pakistan. But instead, we were sent further up north.
You wound up in Kandahar just as the American assault on the city began. Is that when? No, that's not true.
Kunduz.
Oh, Kunduz. Yeah. And that's when you decided to leave?
No. What happened when we got in Kunduz, we were stuck there for a while.
That would have been a Taliban stronghold, hadn't it?
Yeah, it was a Taliban stronghold, and we were just there because we were sent there. We had no idea where it was, and we had no other choice to be with the Taliban because they were the government of that country at the time, and they were surrendering themselves over to Northern Alliance, and we had to be with them because we were told if we don't surrender, you know, you will get killed by the Northern Alliance, so we had no other choice. So we just had to tag along with the Taliban government.
And the film suggests that you were so totally confused that when you thought you were going to back to Pakistan, you wound up actually going north instead of south.
Exactly. We had to leave when we was in Kabul. You know, we wanted to go back to Pakistan because we wasn't doing very much in Afghanistan, and also we only wanted to be in Afghanistan for only a week or so, but it was like it had been like about 3 weeks to 4 weeks, so we were getting really tired. You know, as his dad was waiting for us in Pakistan, plus, you know, his dad was also arranging the wedding, so we knew this, so we knew we had to get back. So when we asked to leave, the person in charge said, yeah, you can go back, but he put us on a bus, and instead of going to Pakistan, we ended up in the north, more further up north.
And that's where your real problems began. I'm talking with Ruhul Ahmed and Michael Winterbottom, who is the co-director of the new film called The Road to Guantanamo, which opens tomorrow at the Angelica and the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And Ruhul, I can hear that you have a child in the background. How old is he or she?
It's not my child, it's my nephew. He's 2 years old.
Now, Michael, where did you film this? Because it really does look like you are going from Pakistan to Afghanistan and then to Guantanamo.
Yeah, the first section we filmed, we started in England, obviously, and we went to Karachi in Pakistan.
So the Karachi is really in Karachi.
Yeah, and we traveled through Pakistan and went into Afghanistan as far as Kabul, which is really the sort of the journey part, the road movie part of the film. And then the next section was the sort of the war bit of the film, and we felt it was too dangerous to do that in Afghanistan. But I'd filmed before in southern Iran, and in southern Iran the geography is very similar, and also you had the right ethnic mix of Uzbekis, Afghan people, Pakistanis, so that we were able to kind of recreate it pretty well. There's a lot of archive footage from the fall of Kunduz and the convoy. So some of the film is archive, and some of the film is our recreation.
So there's documentary mixed in with feature film shooting. But is it easy to shoot in Iran? Could you just get permits? I suspect they are more likely to give you one than me one.
Well, the situation in Iran is, in this case, we weren't making a film about Iran. I think perhaps if you're making a film about Iran, you have to get a lot of permissions. In this case, because the film wasn't set there, it was fine.
But they also gave you help, didn't they? They provided you with military material and the like?
No, it's just as you would do in any country. We worked with a film production team there. And so, yeah, like, obviously, we had to rent guns and like things, but just in the way you would in any country, really. I mean, I have to say, it's sort of, you know, slightly trickier. Some of the filming in Pakistan was probably slightly more trickier than filming in Iran, really.
And where did you shoot the scenes in Guantanamo Bay?
That was in Tehran, Yeah, because yeah, as I said before, we had to really find a match for Afghanistan. So as we were there for about 3 weeks filming that section of the film, it was easier to build that there.
Rule, were you on the set for any of this?
I went all the way through to Pakistan with them. I was asked if I wanted to go to Afghanistan, but I declined.
You'd already been. So tell us about your arrest. You were arrested by the Northern Northern Alliance?
Well, I wouldn't call it an arrest because at the time Taliban government were making negotiations with the Northern Alliance, and the deal was done that they would give up Kunduz and the weapons and the cars and money, etc., and Northern Alliance will give them a safe way to back to Pakistan, back to Kandahar. And we had to be in that, we was just in that convoy as well with the Taliban, who were surrendering themselves over to Northern Alliance. So that's how I got caught up with the Northern Alliance. So basically I had to hand myself over, even though I wasn't a Taliban fighter at all, or in any way. I had to surrender myself just to get to Kandahar, which we thought we would be going there, but instead they put us in a prison called Shahrwardgarh from exactly a month. Then later on we was handed over to the US forces.
The coalition authorities. How much of a factor in everything that followed was the fact that you are an English speaker?
Can you repeat that, please?
Was the fact that you could speak English a factor in all the things that followed, all the problems you had?
Yeah, when we were in Shahrwardgarh, they told us not to tell anybody that we was from England, because we could have problems with the Northern Alliance, or we could be, you know, sold to the U.S. So we never told nobody we was English.
But then you did reveal it, and do you think that was a good or a bad idea? Should you have continued to make believe that you were from Pakistan?
I don't know, because there were a lot of detainees who, because in that prison in Shahrwardgarh there was over 5,000 prisoners in Shahrwardgarh, and the majority were Taliban fighters, and the Americans only took about 100 or so to Guantanamo for some reason, and the rest, the 4,000 and odd, still stayed in Shahrwardgarh prison, and later on they got released to the home countries or to the authorities. I don't know if it would have been a good idea to have concealed, if I was not British or not. I'm not sure. I don't know.
But you were among the 100 who were sent to Guantanamo, along with Asif and Shafiq, all of you English speakers from Tipton.
Yeah, it was basically 2 days before the Americans came. We told the British Red Cross, the ICRC, International Committee of Red Cross, to inform the British government that we are in this prison in Afghanistan. And the Red Cross personnel, he came back the following day and he said he faxed details to the embassy, the British embassy in Islamabad in Pakistan, and they've also faxed the British government in England. And only 2 days later, the Americans came and asked the prison guards in Shahrwardgarh to get all the people who speak English. So it was a bit weird. I mean, I believe that it was probably most likely the British authorities who informed the Americans that they are people from the UK in that prison.
And I suspect partly because they felt that they could interrogate you without using a translator.
And extract information.
And so you were flown to Guantanamo. You were there, you actually, your friends, Asif and Shafiq, were sent there first and then you a little later, but you got there fairly early in this whole story. What was Guantanamo like? What were the conditions like when you arrived?
I think the best way to describe it, it's inexplicable really, to explain to someone how was Guantanamo. It's just really hard to explain. It's hard for them to understand.
Watch the film.
I would say it's like a zoo, basically a cage in the middle of nowhere without a roof.
So you were in a cage outside?
Yeah.
Does that mean when it rained on you, or didn't it rain?
When it rained, and if it rained, it would rain directly on us. We would get wet. All our blankets would get wet. The cell was just bare. It had just the fence around us. It had no bunks. It was just like concrete floor, and we had two buckets. One to drink water out of, like animal, without even giving glasses or cups, and another bucket to urinate and defecate in. So it was like we were treated like animals, and we had to sit in the one position, staring at one side, and the sun, in the day, the sun would beat down on you, and you couldn't hang towels or your sheet on the fence to block the sun ray, because that was breaking camp rules. So we had to like in the day we had to just really sit in one position and boil to death.
Now, Michael, how did you and Matt Whitecross construct this story? Did you rely totally on what Rul, Shafiq, and Asif told you, or were you able to talk to other people as well?
Well, the film is them telling their story. Obviously, like most, like everyone else in Guantanamo, they didn't have a chance to go to court to tell what happened to them. So this film was an opportunity for them to tell their story. But there isn't, you know, I think especially if you're talking about the Guantanamo section, you know, I think there's other kind of forms of corroboration. We showed it to Clive Stafford Smith, their lawyer in America, who represents a lot of other detainees. And what he said was that he thought, A, that it was accurate, but it also gave, in a way, a rather kind of rosy picture of Guantanamo compared to the experiences of some of his other clients. That what you see in the film, the conditions in the film are very, you know, are correct, but also the interrogation techniques that are used in the film, things like stress positions, strobe lighting, and so on. These are the kind of routines. This is not a film which is showing you, isn't this disgraceful, some soldiers got out of hand, or this is exposing some abuse of the system. All we're showing you in the film is what is the regular, normal procedures within Guantanamo. And hopefully if you watch the film and you see them, you see that what they went through, you can decide for yourself, but I think most people feel those procedures aren't correct.
Well, it's very difficult to watch some of them. First of all, you've done it very effectively, and we do feel the stress that they're going through. We feel that sense of it's so unfair what's happening. Even if some people were culpable to some degree, the way the interrogations are handled, for example, just seem to be, in fact, they seem to be counterproductive at times. They don't seem to really be interested in trying to get real information, but rather to do something else.
I think so. And you have to remember as well that, I mean, if you're at war with someone, you pick up prisoners on the battlefield. They're supposed to be prisoners of war. If you're a prisoner of war, you're not allowed to be interrogated. You have the right to just give the basic information about who you are. Then after that, you're not allowed to be interrogated like this. So to have any kind of form of ongoing interrogation would, if they had the protection of the Geneva Conventions, be illegal. And then the nature of the interrogations as they are is, of course, incredibly coercive. And in a way, is a way of generating masses of information, most of which is probably useless or false.
My guests are Michael Winterbottom, co-director of The Road to Guantanamo, which opens tomorrow at the Angelica and the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas. It won the Silver Bear for Best Director at the Berlin Film Festival. And with us by phone is Rul Ahmed, one of the Tipton Three, whose story the film tells. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Michael Winterbottom, co-director, I should say, although mostly the director, I'm assuming, considering all of your background, of The Road to Guantanamo, which opens tomorrow at the Angelica and the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, and by phone, Rul Ahmed, one of the Tipton Three, whose story is told in this film. And so you're in these cages, and you're being interrogated. And then the situation got a little better. What led to you being allowed to stay indoors?
Well, we were never allowed to stay indoors. What happened was Camp X-Ray was just like an open prison, open in the open fields. And later on, they built another facility called Camp Delta, which were more kind of indoor. They just had a roof, and it was just like all covered. Covered off, basically. It was all just made of metal. The roof was made of metal, but there were still gaps. You would have windows on the back, and if it did rain, you still get wet. So that cell was similar. I mean, it's still a cage like animal, but you had a bunk, and you had a sink in your cell, and a toilet in your cell, and that was about it. There's not much difference, really.
Michael, when you were researching this and you looked at old news clips from that period, were you surprised by the way Guantanamo was portrayed?
Well, I think at the beginning, especially looking at the TV news archive, you know, you could hear in the journalist reports the kind of sense of confusion and shock and at the fact that there was an American prison in Cuba. I mean, what's going on? Why is the American prison in Cuba? And obviously, you know, in the end, the reason it's there, and sometimes it's hard to see the big things for the detail, but the reason Guantanamo exists at all is because if that prison was in America, it would be illegal. They wouldn't be able to be held without any trial for 4 years in America. Equally, you know, they were trying to avoid international law, because if they said they were prisoners of war, then they would have had the protection of the Geneva Convention. So I think, you know, at the beginning, everyone was very shocked. And then sort of 2 years later, you know, people had just forgotten about it and got used to the idea that there was a Guantanamo.
Ruhl, did you ever meet anyone there who admitted to being a member of Al-Qaeda?
I met enough Chinese who admitted to being Al-Qaeda because of the... they got tortured. I myself committed. Said that I was a member of Al Qaeda because I was tortured.
No, I meant somebody who you really believe was a member of Al Qaeda.
No. I haven't. If there were, then they should have been taken to court.
Well, approximately 10 people have been charged, but there were 750 or so imprisoned there.
But what have they been charged with?
I'm not exactly sure what. But
I don't think nobody knows that. What they've been charged with, no one knows. And, you know, they've been those 10 people have been taken to a court, which is a military tribunal, which is totally, totally biased. You know, they can't even choose their own lawyers. So I don't believe in that, the allegation they have on those 10.
In an op-ed piece in last week's New York Times, Murad Benchalali described his despair during his 2.5 years as a prisoner in Guantanamo. Were you ever overcome by that role?
Of course.
So how do you deal with that? What was going on?
I think it's just, you know, when you go to prison, you have to like kind of adapt to that lifestyle, you know, especially with Guantanamo. It was like they had to learn to be patient and to somehow blank out every thought and every feeling and just kind of stare, you know, at your cell, in a certain part of the cell, and just look at it for hours and hours and hours.
Did you join in any of the hunger strikes? Because there were hunger strikes even from the start.
Yeah, the very first hunger strike took place because in my block, because one of the soldiers kicked the Quran, and I took part in that for a day or two, but there was many detainees who continued for weeks. One detainee went over 100 days.
And there were 41 attempted suicides, at least so far, and 3 successful ones last week. We get the sense that the guards on the whole were rather aggressive, but in one scene, a guard saves one of you from a scorpion bite, so it wasn't totally terrible?
No. In terms of soldiers, I mean, I would say 95% were just really bad, evil, and 5% were good. So I wouldn't say all of them were bad. No.
Now, all of you...
And you just said there's been 46 records of people committing suicide. But when I was in Guantanamo Bay, there was people in the hundreds who was committing suicide.
That haven't been reported, you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. They haven't been reported. I mean,
well, also, they changed the description. They changed people. They had created a new definition, SIB, which was a sort of, instead of saying attempted suicides, to reduce the number of reported attempted suicides. Well, and one thing that's been happening all along is that language is being used to hide sort of things that are going on. So, you know, outside Guantanamo, the motto of Guantanamo is honor bound to defend freedom. It's a bit of a distortion of language to think honor or freedom could be found in a prison like Guantanamo.
Did you have any contact with the outside? Were you able to exchange letters with your family?
We should write letters. I think there's 6 letters per month, and I should receive letters, but it should take about, I don't know how long it should take for letters to get to my family, but I should receive letters from my family, and they should be 6 months late. They should get to me after 6 months. And most of the letters that I received were heavily censored, so the first line would be dear son or dear brother, and the very last line would be goodbye, take care, and the rest would be censored out. And many letters of mine that I have, when I came back from Guantanamo, they kept all the letters that I sent, and majority of them were just like how I was and how are you, you know, or should I just general letters, and how are you, what's that, or, you know, what you do in your life, are you in university, are you studying? And all that would be actually censored. All that would be censored. And all you could see is like, dear, to my brother or to mom, to dad, and at the end, love you, bye, hoo how. That's it. So it would be heavily censored.
How long before they started showing you what they said was evidence of your complicity? Videos and photographs. There was a video in which they spotted the 3 of you in the crowd as Osama bin Laden was speaking.
That was that allegation came about, I think it was after 1 year and 3 months. But before that, there were many allegations. There were many allegations. They said they found our passports and documentation in a cave in Afghanistan, and all these nonsense. And about the video, the picture quality was so poor that it was unbelievable that I could actually turn around and say it was you. But it was just they needed to pin something down on us, you know. They wanted to use us, personally, they wanted us to be scapegoats, really. They needed to sacrifice somebody.
But didn't you have an easily traceable alibi for the time that they said you'd spend in Afghanistan in 2000?
We did. You know, I was in court and I was on bail. At the same time, I was doing probation.
Wait, so you were through the British legal system, which would have, I guess, would have been easily traced?
It could have been traced within 24 hours, but it took five months for the British to come around and say, oh, these guys, you know, couldn't have been in Afghanistan in the year 2000 in that video with Osama bin Laden. But it took them 5 years, 5 months to say that.
Meanwhile, you had all confessed, you said.
Yeah, after about 4.5 months or 5 months, we all confessed to being in that video, and we also confessed that we were fighters.
And you did that because of the interrogation techniques? How difficult were they to withstand?
Pardon?
Obviously, the interrogation techniques are really rough. Could we call it torture, or was it just very, very heavily coercive?
I think according to international law, they would call it torture. And we were tortured for five months, and that's the reason I confessed.
Now, why do you think the British officials took so long to back up your alibi? In fact, why do you think that they didn't pressure for some kind of contact with you?
I don't know why it took them so long, but you know, the British government also have a big part to play in Guantanamo from day one. And I think the only reason we got released is because of the pressure on Tony Blair.
Michael, has this film been shown in Britain yet?
Yeah, we showed the film first of all in Berlin at the end of January, beginning of February, and then it was shown on TV and in cinemas in March, I think, in Britain. And you know, as we were saying, obviously the British government has been a big ally of America in all its foreign policy recently. But since then, I mean, the two chief kind of government legal officers, the Attorney General and Lord Chancellor, have both said they think Guantanamo is illegal and should close.
And pressured the U.S. government to release some people. But that was not the case of the Tipton Three. They got out for other reasons?
No, the only reason you can't get out by proving your innocence in Guantanamo because you don't have to be charged with anything. So the vast majority of people haven't been charged with anything. So just proving that you weren't in the video doesn't mean you get released. It was a deal done between the British government and the Americans that got them released.
Do you see this film as a way of raising awareness of what's going on at Guantanamo? Because I read a Pew Research Center poll that last week reveals that only 75% of Americans are aware of the torture at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, compared to 90% of Western Europeans.
Well, I hope it does remind people of Guantanamo. And also, just by seeing three individuals, remind you that there's still 460 other individuals who are still there 4 years later.
Wasn't the first poster design for the American release of the movie rejected?
Yeah, apparently the original poster had a prisoner with a hood over his head, and I think it was the MPAA. I decided that would be too distressing for people to see. Not too distressing, obviously, for it to be done to prisoners, but too distressing for people to see in a poster.
But we've already seen people with hoods on their heads in photographs from Abu Ghraib.
I know. I don't understand why.
Newsreel footage.
Exactly. And then there was a quote from Michael Moore saying every American should see this film. And apparently they objected to that as well. But I don't know why.
So what happened when they decided to release you, Rule? Were you treated any differently?
No, just one day they came to us and said, "You're going home tomorrow." And before we they released us, they took us to this this place and they tried to make us sign a document. And in the document, you stated that I, Rual Ahmed, have been detaining Guantanamo Bay because of having terrorist links with Al Qaeda and something with Taliban, and if ever we have any information of you having links with any terrorist organizations throughout the world, we can come and arrest you in your home place. They wanted us to sign that piece of paper, But everybody denied, rejected that to sign that paper, and they said to us, you all be going home. But the next day, we were flown back to UK.
So, and nobody said, we made a mistake, we're sorry, or anything
no,
like that?
Never. Nobody has ever said that.
Your friend, Shafiq, is the Russell versus Bush, the 2003 Supreme Court decision that held that prisoners at Guantanamo had the right to challenge their detention in U.S. courts. Were you aware that your case had been taken up by lawyers?
No, we had not. We didn't even believe, we didn't even know we had lawyers. Because we were in Guantanamo, and it made no sense to have lawyers. I mean, because it was not a regular prison. I mean, we were denied basic human rights. So in our mind, we were thinking, hold on, if we are denied basic human rights and the Geneva Convention doesn't apply to us, how can we have lawyers? So in our mind in Guantanamo, we never believed that we had lawyers until we came home. The night we came home, we was arrested by the British police and taken to Paddington Green in the police station. And that's the first time I met my lawyer. And he came over to me and shook my hand and goes, I am your lawyer. And I was just gobsmacked. I was like, well, how come I got a lawyer? Who assigned you to me?
So that was something that was done so totally separately. Was your family involved in
that?
Yeah,
my family was involved.
Now, I understand that you, Shafiq, and Asif are planning to file a suit against Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. What are you accusing him of?
You know, to be honest with you, I think I'm not really sure because it's Clive Stafford Smith, who is a lawyer in the U.S. He's doing all the case, and I haven't got a clue what's happening. But I think it's for violation of religious rights.
Mm-hmm. You were released into British custody. What did the British authorities do when you came back home? Did they say, boy, we're sorry that this happened to you?
No, they actually arrested us under the grounds of Terrorism Act 2000 and arrested and detained us for, I think, 2 days in Paddington Green. And thereafter, they released us without any charges, without any apology or any excuse, really.
At the end of the film, Michael, you ask the three men, how has this changed you? Were you surprised by how much, at most, it was quiet outrage? They really weren't as angry as most of us might have expected?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously it's a terrible experience, but when you spend time with Royal Chef and Asif, they're really nice guys. You know, they're incredibly kind of normal and just getting on with things. And, as they said in the film, I think one thing that they said, one of the good things to take out of the experience was that they found their religion, and their religion has been a sort of source of strength to them.
Mm-hmm. President Bush has said, he said earlier this month that he'd like to close the camp eventually. What do you think about that rule?
I think it's stupid.
You think it's stupid just to close the camp, or stupid that it's open in the first place?
I think it's stupid because he opened the camp in the first place. I mean, if you remember when he first opened the place, he said, you know, these guys in Guantanamo are the worst of the worst. Them killers, they don't share the same value. And now, today, he's saying that Guantanamo Bay should be closed down. He doesn't know what he's doing. You know, he's only trying to, at the moment, because he's got so much pressure because of all the European countries putting pressure on him. You know, he's got to save his ass. He's got to save himself, so he's got to look good and say, you know, we need to close Guantanamo Bay down. But there are killers there. You know, if there are killers there, take him to court.
And do you think that that your film, Michael, will in any way change American opinions, or are they so hardened these days that people will take from this whatever they already bring to it?
Well, obviously, the kind of most important audience for the film is the audience in America, because it's Americans who can close down Guantanamo. Obviously, one film isn't going to change the world, but you kind of hope every time, every newspaper article, every story you hear about the situation there, you hope it persuades people that something has to be done quite soon.
Have the recent events like the three suicides affected British public opinion?
I think, to be honest, British public opinion is pretty hostile to Guantanamo anyway. And, I think that is what's been happening, is bit by bit people have become more and more cynical about the claims that these guys are the worst of the worst. You know, it was very anonymous at first. They were all sort of, it was always long-distance images of these guys, and we were told these are terrible, dangerous criminals. And I think now people don't really believe that.
Ruhl, have you been able to pick up your life where you left it?
No, I haven't. I'm trying, but I don't think I'll ever, pick it up again.
What are you doing these days?
Well, We came out from Guantanamo in 2004, and in June, July, we start talking to Michael about the film, start doing the interviews in October, November time, December time, until the film was just recently finished last year, March, or this year, March, when the film was released. And we've been just travelling from since the film's been released till this day, we've been just travelling around most of Europe, promoting the film and doing a lot of interviews and conferences with Amnesty International on this topic.
Now, Michael, tonight you will be participating in a question and answer after a special screening of the movie at the IFC Center. It says with the Tipton 3. Oh, by phone?
I think it's by some sort of internet connection, actually, uh-huh. Yeah.
If you want more information about that, by the way, you can find it on our show page at wnyc.org. And my great thanks to Michael Winterbottom, whose other films include A Cock and Bull Story, Nine Songs, Jude, I Want You, his latest, The Road to Guantanamo, done with Matt Whitecross. And my great thanks to you, Rule Ahmed, for participating as well. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.